Let's turn our attention now to the Word of God. We're going to read together from Luke's Gospel in chapter 20, the first half of that chapter, which is mainly what we sometimes call the parable of the tenants, or the tenants in the vineyard. Luke's Gospel chapter 20 begins around page 1054 of the church Bibles that you'll find underneath the seats in front of you. And I'd encourage you to have that passage open so that we can both read it and follow it through together as we think about what Jesus said and how it applies to us. And this is really getting pretty close to the climax of Luke's account of Jesus' life, although the gospel itself goes on for another, I think, four chapters before it concludes. What happens in this gospel and all the others is that the story slows right down when we get into the last week of Jesus' life. So although it's 24 chapters covering the 30-odd years that Jesus lived on earth, you will see, if you know the Christian story at all, that Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem as king on Palm Sunday, which happened just a week before his death and resurrection, where you'll see that at the start, at the end of chapter 19, just before the bit that we read. Jesus came to Jerusalem, the crowds proclaimed him as king, he went into the temple and drove out those who were trading there so that people could pray there instead. And so we go on into the last week of Jesus' life. So where our passage begins with the words, one day, as Jesus was teaching the people, actually the choice of days that you have for that is either Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or just possibly Thursday of what we call Holy Week, the last week of Jesus' life. So death and resurrection, crucifixion and atonement is just around the corner. And that concentrates our minds on what Jesus is saying and the salvation that he comes to bring. So let me read to you and follow with me as we read together. In Luke's Gospel chapter 20 from verse 1. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts and proclaiming the good news, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, together with the elders, came up to him. Tell us, by what authority you are doing these things, they said. Who gave you this authority? He replied, I will also ask you a question. Tell me, John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? They discussed it among themselves and said, if we say from heaven, he will ask, why didn't you believe him? But if we say of human origin, all the people will stone us because they are persuaded that John was a prophet. So they answered, we don't know where it was from. Jesus said, neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things. But he went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants, so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him, the servant, and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but that one also they beat and treated shamefully, and sent him away empty-handed. He sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said. Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, God forbid. Jesus looked directly at them and asked, Then what is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. That's a quotation from Psalm 118, which is a king's coronation psalm, or perhaps a psalm sang on the anniversary of a coronation, and it describes a king who nobody wanted, and then later on was crowned, like David, who was a shepherd boy, and then a refugee before he became king. The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. And everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately, because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. But they were afraid of the people. Amen. And I pray that God will help us to see and hear what he's saying to us today. Tell me this, as a Christian, do you see yourself as someone who is under the authority of others? Perhaps the government or the state, we are bound to obey the laws of the land. We are bound to conform to the norms of our culture. We have to do what is expected of us. We have to meet the expectations of our friends. If they ask us to do them a favor, then it's kind of necessary that we do what they say. Do you see yourself under the authority of others? Or do you see yourself as free from all authority, liberated and able to exercise your own religious freedom so you can believe what you want and do what you want? You can choose which church you go to and what part you play in it, what to get involved in. And you can interpret the Bible in any way that seems to be right to you. You have the last word. You have the final say. Or do you see yourself as under God's authority? That is to say, he is an overpowering, an overwhelming authority figure who requires you to serve him in obedient and sometimes in sacrificial ways, and sometimes needs you to believe things and to do things that you don't really understand. Why do you do that? Why do you believe that? Because God says. No questions asked. Under whose authority do you act? That's the question they ask of Jesus in verse 2 of our reading today. And it was asked by the chief priests who ran the temple, the elders who ran the Jewish community, and the teachers of the law who ran the synagogues and did the Bible teaching. And it's not surprising they came and asked Jesus, because he was challenging all of their authority. He had just been proclaimed king, riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. And when the Pharisees said, tell your followers to stop doing this because you're not the king, if you look, it says that Jesus told them that if the people didn't crown him, then the very stones lying at the side of the road would praise him as David's son. And then he'd gone into the temple itself, right into the control center of Jewish authority, if you like. And he'd said, you're doing all this wrong. And he flung over the tables and he drove out the people who shouldn't be there, and he let in the people who had come to pray. So they are coming to him and saying, who do you think you are to make these constitutional and ecclesiastical and social and legal changes? What gives you the right to take charge? And it's a good question, because those who are enemies of Jesus need to know what they're up against, and those who might become his disciples need to know what they're being asked to follow. Whose authority are you acting under? And yet Jesus answers the question with a question, and then goes on to tell this parable of the tenants. Now, in the face of it, it seems a pretty thin story to make a teaching point out of. You could kind of summarize it up very briefly and say a landowner had some trouble with his tenants, and so he eventually evicted them and replaced them. And you think, what could be more humdrum or ordinary or unremarkable than that, and what are we meant to make of it? But what we need to do, as with many of the parables that Jesus tells, what we need to do is look for the point by looking for the surprise. Jesus sucks us into the everyday story of farming folks and then drops a clanger in the midst of it when something happens that we didn't expect. And that's the point of the story. And I think the point of this story that we shouldn't really expect is the whole of verses 11 to 15. Which in an everyday story of ordinary farming folk just wouldn't be there. It would move naturally from verse 10, which says, the tenants beat the rent-collecting servant and sent him away empty-handed, jump straight from there to verse 16, where the owner will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others, and that is the way that the story should flow. Perhaps coming to kill tenants who withhold their rent is a little bit more brutal than we would expect, but these were brutal times. Clearly, some decisive reaction to non-payment was necessary and made economic sense. So the surprise is how far the owner's patience extends, that we don't jump from verse 10 to verse 16, but to verse 11, where after the first servant has been rejected, a second one is sent. And after the second servant has been not just rejected, but shamed and humiliated in some way, a third servant is sent. And when the third servant is not just made a fool of, but physically assaulted, the owner sends his son. Because he still has it in his mind or on his heart to persuade these tenants that he's already got to keep their side of the bargain. And it's only after that son is killed that he abandons that hope. But the time it takes him to reach that stage and the risks he runs and the costs he endures is the surprise at the heart of this story. So what does it mean? Well, clearly the owner represents God. And the rent which the tenant should be paying to him is the respect that people owe him. It's the sacrifice of praise and worship and the obedience of faith and divine service. And clearly, although it hadn't quite happened yet, but was just about to, clearly the slaughtered son is Jesus, God's son sent as a last attempt to persuade people to give God his due. Coming after God had sent his servants, the prophets, to try throughout Old Testament generations to call people back to himself and to their covenant with him. So when we get to verse 13, which is the point at which the owner of the vineyard decides to send his son, what we have is a precious insight into God's thinking at the incarnation. Jesus is born into the world to live among us, to serve us, and finally to die for us. What was God thinking about when he did that? This parable tells us. And what it tells us, first of all, and perhaps most remarkably, is this, that God was thinking about it. Okay, verse 13 doesn't say, the owner says, now I know what I'm going to do. I've been left with no choice. You see the owner asking himself, what shall I do? He asks himself in verse 13. He is trying to make up his mind. Now, how remarkable is that? If I fail to pay my electricity bill, for example, then nobody thinks about it. Something is done about it. I get a reminder notice and then a final demand and then I'll eventually be cut off. But all that happens automatically. There are procedures set in place that are simply followed, probably by a computer. Nobody gives it a moment's thought. If my credit card expires, then Nobody wonders what to do. I just put it in the chip and pin machine and enter my number, but the payment is rejected. But when I sin, even repeatedly, like these tenants in the vineyard, when I sin, it makes God stop and think. And I don't think that's because he's indecisive. He hasn't worked out what his options are, or he doesn't have the courage to act in his convictions. I don't think it's because he's taken by surprise. I think it's because it affects him personally. Something happens and it has an impact on him. And so he has to give his attention to it. So we don't have a God who acts automatically, following procedures, or who just simply keeps trotting out the same old line again and again and again, following historic precedent, or who is bound by a codified set of rules that reduces him to the level of an administrator. We have a God who lives by making conscious choices, who is on the case, who is involved because he is affected by everything that we do and everything that happens around us. This thinking, feeling, conscientious God, who may be up there in the distance running the whole universe all at once, but who is also focused on whatever it is that's happening to us. And here we find him troubled over, angsting over our actions. And I'm not sure that we give God the credit for that he really deserves. I think sometimes when we sin and know that we've done something wrong, it kind of hits us in the face that we shouldn't have done that. We kind of hope that God hasn't noticed, that we might get away with it, or at least that he'll overlook it because we've done some other good things that week or this lifetime that will make up for it, or it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And then if we carry on sinning and it becomes a habit, just a part of our lifestyle, our character almost, then we kind of hope that God's got used to the idea. He is, after all, a patient, loving God, isn't he? So he'll get over it. Where the truth is that all the time he is thinking and wondering and bothering himself, troubling himself about what to do with it. What shall I do, he asks, as he tries to resolve this tension which has been created in the universe because somebody hasn't done what he knows and loves that they should have done. So he never gets out of the habit of noticing us, and then his decision, not his automatic reaction, but his decision is to sacrifice his son. In verse 13, I will send my son whom I love. And these words, if you know the Bible story, repeat exactly what the voice from heaven said at Jesus' baptism. This is my own dear son whom I love. So just in case you missed it, it is becoming abundantly clear that in this parable, it's about the Father sending his son to die on the cross. He sacrifices his son, knowing that in doing so, he's taking a risk. I will send my son, he says, perhaps they will respect him. And of course, perhaps means maybe they won't. Perhaps Aberdeen will win the Premier League this year. Perhaps I'll win the lottery if I buy a ticket. Perhaps they will respect him. So what we see here is that God is choosing grace. He's choosing a course of action that he cannot control, instead of the certainty of judgment. So where the everyday story of farming folk would have leapt from verse 10 to verse 16 that says the owner will take the vineyard back from those tenants because they don't deserve it, God chooses otherwise, when far bigger things are at stake. Because what he really, really wants in his heart of hearts is not just the vineyard up and running, but the tenants' voluntary submission, the respect, the faith. He'd rather have that than their forced surrender, which he can have like that at any time. So when it comes to that that question of authority, what makes us choose to do what we do, what we have is a God who lets us get it wrong sometimes. Because we're ignorant and haven't understood what he wants, or because we've been misled by people who've given us a bad role model to follow, or because we are confused because there seem to be competing claims or choices that we could make, or even when, like the tenants here, we're being deliberately greedy. I know exactly what God wants and exactly what I owe him, and I'm going to do this instead. For far longer than any businessman or landowner would let their customer or their clients get away with non-payment, God waits. And more than that, he acts to get us back. So, you see, in the context of Luke chapter 20, when Jesus tells this story as a follow-up to the question that the Jewish authorities asked, he follows their question with his question about John's authority, John the Baptist. Did his authority come from heaven or of human origin? And they were unable to make up their minds, or at least unwilling to make a public statement about where they thought John's authority and therefore Jesus' authority, which was tied to it, came from. Jesus went on to tell this parable not to change the subject, but to deal with the issue, to show them that they had a God who both cared very much about their answer to that question of authority and who wants to give them every chance to get the answer right. Doing all he can not to have to impose his authority on them, because what he craves is their respect. Have you ever asked that question? Why does God not just stop sin? Why does he not prevent bad things from happening? Why can he not be decisive like a strong government or a hard-headed businessman dealing in outcomes and facts and figures? And the answer is because he cares about the sinner. It's not that he doesn't care about the sin as well. He clearly does deeply. But what he wants is for the sinner to put a stop to their own sin rather than leaving it up to him to do it his way. And that patience of God is the gospel appeal to all of us, an appeal to think over what our actions are doing to him, and so to choose to do otherwise because he deserves better. So that what we end up with if we respond to Jesus' gospel invitation is not a selfish salvation which says, I've found out that sinning hurts, so I want God to rescue me from the consequences of my actions. And not a fearful salvation of people who have heard that there's judgment and hellfire to come in the next life and they want to get out of that in time, but a faithful salvation. The salvation of people recognizing what God's goodness deserves and what his grace longs for and what his sacrifice provides. Because God is thinking about that all the time. That is the focus of his attention. And all he wants us to do is to think about it like he does. To see it from his point of view. And to do what he is hoping for. Now, of course, God doesn't always get that. And this parable does end on a decisive, violent note which shows that there are times when God's patience expires, if you like. But also shows that God's patience should not be mistaken for weakness. I've been doing this all the time and God hasn't put a stop to it yet, so it can't bother him all that much. If his perhaps they will respect me becomes our perhaps I won't bother, then eventually inevitable consequences will follow. In verse 16, he will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others, because heaven cannot be home to unbelievers. But then, just as we think we've got to the end of the parable, another surprise hits us in the face in terms of the people's reaction. When the people heard this, they said, "God forbid." So what seems to us to be a very reasonable reaction of the tenant, of the owner to his tenants, or of God to those who refuse to respond to his offer of grace, what seems to us to be even strangely delayed is deeply shocking to those who heard the story. Why do they appeal to God to forbid justice? God forbid. Well, the answer to that is because their thoughts about this passage were influenced by another story or a song which they knew. It was a song that was sung by the prophet Isaiah in chapter 5 of his prophecy, known as the Song of the Vineyard. And it was a well-known picture of the history of Israel. And this is what it says. It says, "I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He put a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. And then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit." And that song goes on, if you read the rest of chapter 5 of Isaiah, to describe God's destruction of that vineyard which he had planted. He allows it to fall into ruin and wild animals to come in through the walls or the fences and to tear it apart. God's destruction of Israel, his fertile but barren vineyard. And the Jews in Jesus' day understood that song historically, because they knew that a long time ago Israel had abandoned God and repeatedly ignored the messages sent by the Old Testament prophets, and so God had abandoned them to Babylonian invasion and exile. So as far as they were concerned, the Song of the Vineyard had been sung right to the end. The bad times had come upon them. And what they were looking for now was this donkey riding Jesus, Messiah, to come and restore them again and put a king back on the throne of Israel and give her control of her wealth and restore her to God's favor and fortune. So when Jesus comes and sings the vineyard song again, if you like, albeit this time in the form of a parable or a story, but in the process brings it bang up to date, he's saying, "You are still rebellious." And then he adds into the story the murder of God's son on top of the rejection of the prophets, and tells them that their last chance of salvation has been blown. God forbid, then becomes the only possible reaction if you understand the story. So what's the point of all of this? If not even God's son can change people's minds, then why bother telling the story or even sending him at all? Why not just jump to verse 16 and the repossession by God of his vineyard? Well, Jesus coming and teaching is not a waste of time. It just demands our careful attention. Because what you will see in Isaiah's song is that Israel is the vineyard which yielded only bad fruit. And later on in the chapter, the vineyard itself is destroyed. But what Jesus' story does is insert tenants into the vineyard, if you like, standing between God and the fruit-bearing plants. Tenants who are in charge of the vineyard and under obligation to God. So when the good fruit is not forthcoming, it's not the vineyard that gets destroyed in the parable, but the tenants who are held accountable, first of all, positively in the hope of encouraging them to get the best out of them, and then finally replacing them. But the vineyard remains, you see? So the parable is all about authority. Who is in charge of the people of God? And that's why in verse 19, they got it. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. They had come to question him in verse 1, tell us by what authority you are doing these things. And his reply is to turn the tables on them to say, by what authority do you reject Jesus Christ as the Son of God? And if, of course, it's true that they don't listen to him and this story about the owner's son being thrown outside and killed is powerfully prophetic of crucifixion of Jesus outside the city walls in just a couple of days' time. They don't listen, and people in authority very rarely do listen, because once you get into authority, your self-esteem depends so much on being right all the time and getting other people to do what you want. That's why Christian leadership is so difficult and should be such a distinctive thing, a different model from the way that people lead in the world. It should be a hierarchy of humility. But the leaders of Israel respond to this story by fulfilling it, by killing Jesus. They've heard it so clearly. They know exactly what it means. They understand that it is directly about them. And yet they've heard it not at all. Was it just a waste of time? Well, no, because you see, other people were listening too. And Luke's mind writing this gospel story, it wasn't written for the leaders of the people of Israel, the Pharisees or the chief priests or the elders or the teachers of the law. It was written for the everyday ordinary folk. And in that sense, it was written for you and me. If you look at the story, it says that while the authorities came to Jesus to question his right to authority, in verse 9, he went on to tell the people this parable. So you can imagine the authority figures towering over him, but the people sitting at his feet, and it's to them that this is addressed. The leaders rejected it, but what was Jesus' message to us? And I think he was asking them why they would ever choose to follow that kind of leadership. See, what we have is tenants in this story who everybody knew would have had some significant status in that society. They weren't actually landowners themselves, but they were the next best thing because the landowner had gone away. So they would have been relatively wealthy. They would have been employing people, and so folks would have been dependent upon them. They would have been in the local chamber of commerce or elected to the city council. They would have been managing the resources in that society and trading in the marketplace. When they walked down the street, people stepped aside for them. When they spoke, people listened. They had status and authority derived from their vineyard, just as the chief priests had a status that derived from their place in the temple hierarchy. And the Pharisees had a certain status because they were well-versed in the teachings of the Jewish law. And the elders had a certain status within the community because they were recognized as the leading authority. But Jesus is saying to the people in front of him, what is the point of submitting to an elder or a chief priest or a teacher of the law who does not themselves submit to God? That would make just as little sense as respecting a tenant who is just about to be replaced by the owner of the vineyard. And so Jesus is saying to all of us, as well as to those people, then we need to make up our minds about the answer to the question which is on everybody's lips here. Does Jesus' authority come from heaven? Or is it of human origin? Because you can't afford to delegate that question to someone else. You can't say, it's too complicated for me, but my leaders tell me this and I'll take their word for it. We can't afford to do that. Live out our lives based on other people's decision, whether it's your church authority or the social norms of our society or your parents or your friends or whoever else it is. Yes, there is a place for leadership in all these places, of course, church, government, society, and so on. But we need to make up our minds to follow those who are following Christ, to be under their influence and guided by their example, and to benefit from their wisdom. Otherwise, we're in real danger. Look at this. Look at verse 6. It says, the leaders would not condemn John as being merely of human origin in case the people stoned them. You see, the people were on side with John the Baptist and Jesus. And in verse 19, they wouldn't arrest Jesus because they were afraid of the people. So Jesus had an audience in front of him who knew their own minds and who were willingly exercising their own religious freedom and would carry on doing that for 5 at the most whole more days. And then in chapter 23, verse 18, it says, with one voice they cried out, away with this man, and release Barabbas to us. With loud shouts in verse 23, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. You see, we cannot trust ourselves to lead us. That's like saying to someone who is falling through thin air to save themselves by grabbing tight hold of the air they're falling through. And we cannot trust other people to lead us either, just on the basis of the authority they appear to have or the status they've been given. But who we can trust is our servant and son-sending master. To put in charge over his vineyard tenants who not only know how to make the fruit grow, but also know that the fruit produced belongs to God and are ready to give the glory to him. And I pray that God will follow with his blessing the reading and the preaching of his word.